You may have remembered, or you may have written down on the first talk, in the first talk, I said that when Banti did his seminar on this text in 1976, it had a tremendous effect on the movement, and I was going to talk a bit about that in the third talk. Well, I'm going to talk about it tomorrow now. It just the way the verses fall out and how far we've got with it so far, it worked better tomorrow, so you'll have to wait. Sorry about that. Just in case you were expecting it today. And just want to say a few words about the text, because we've been hearing it in the evening in the context of the puja. And all Buddhist texts are transformative, in principle transformative. Even if they don't transform you right now, in principle they've got the ability to transform you. If a text is not transformative, it's not really the Dharma, it's something else. And I've come to think that there are basically two kinds of transformative texts. There's informative and there's performative. And the informative texts tell you how to practice so that you can transform yourself. And the performative texts are more like performances which transform you in the moment. In speech act theory, I got this idea from speech act theory, which is that some speech doesn't inform you of anything, but it's an action. For instance, if I say, I promise you that tomorrow I'll tell you about the way this text affected the movement, then that's an action. It's an action on my part, which I have to fulfill. And a wedding ceremony is full of performative speech, because you know exactly what's going to happen at the end of the ceremony, or somewhere in the ceremony. The celebrant says, do you take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife? And you know exactly what the husband-to-be is going to say. And you'd be really surprised if they said, not sure, actually. They say, I do. And no one's surprised, you're not learning anything, but it has to be said. It's an action. And pujas are performative speech. I don't know how many times you've done a puja. I must have done them thousands of times. I don't learn anything new in a puja. But I'm acting out the puja. It's a performance which I need to do. And so today I'll be informing you about what the text means, and in the evening Sridharpa will be reading out as a performance, so that we can sort of reenact the Bodhisattva's life. So today I'm going to go on to a few verses. I'm going to do it a bit differently today. I'm going to look at a few verses rather than just one or two. I'm going to look at those verses where the Buddha in the text, or that you could say the text, whoever wrote the text, defines a few key terms. And when you look at the very early Buddhist text, not this one, but the early Pali text, like the Udana or the Sutta Nipata, you find that that's exactly what the Buddha did. He not only defined what the Dharma was, but he also defined what the Dharma practitioner was. So in the Udana, you get the Buddha again and again redefining a term that the ancient Indians would have known, Brahman, or Brahmin. What is a real Brahmin? This is what a real Brahmin is. In other words, a Buddhist practitioner. And he describes what that means. And then the first sutta of the Sutta Nipata, the sutra on the snake, there are 17 verses where the Buddha defines again and again what a bhikkhu is. This is really what a bhikkhu is. This is what a bhikkhu is, again and again. And so we get this with verse 16 of the text, of our text. Let me just check that I've got it right. Yes, verse 16. Why are such beings called bodhisattvas, awakening beings? And so the Buddha is now, this is an early Mahayana text, remember. So here we are, here's the Buddha redefining what the Buddhist path is, or the no path, what the goal really is, or the no goal, and what the Bodhisattva really is, or the Bodhisattva who's not really a Bodhisattva, or at least if they think they're a Bodhisattva, they're not one. So he's defining what the Bodhisattva really is here, and it's, in a way, it's quite a surprising definition of the Bodhisattva, considering how we think of Bodhisattvas. So what is a Bodhisattva? Verse 16. They want to destroy all forms of attachment, cut them off. That's what a Bodhisattva is. They want to destroy all forms of attachment. They will attain true non-attachment, the awakening of the victorious ones. So enlightenment is true non-attachment, and the Bodhisattva is trying to get rid of all his or her attachments. This is why they are called Bodhisattvas, awakening beings. So I'm going to talk for a while about attachment, and the first thing to do is define it, I think. Sometimes the word is upadana, and sometimes it's defined as clinging. And all forms of attachment. In one of the early Buddhist texts, the Buddha talked about four forms of attachment, and I think these are all forms of attachment. These are the forms of attachment that the Bodhisattva tries to cut off. And the first one is attachment to sensuous pleasures, sense pleasures. The second one is attachment to views. Views about the way things are. The third one is attachment to rites and rituals, which we could say are formal practices. And the fourth one is attachment to an idea of the self. So I'm going to talk about each one of those and how we let go of those attachments. But before I do that, I would just want to define attachment, because it's a word we use a lot, attachment, non-attachment, clinging, etc. What it actually means, I think, is emotional dependency. When you're attached to something, you depend on it emotionally. And then another question arises, what do we mean by emotional dependency? And I think what emotional dependency really is a sense in which your sense of well-being is dependent on you getting something. So we're dependent, emotionally dependent on lots and lots of things, and most of the time we're not aware of that because we've got them. So as long as we've got them, we don't need to worry about them because we feel okay. So for instance, I'm very emotionally dependent on my flat in Salford. It's a lovely little flat with a lovely view, and it's really quiet, and it suits me really well. And as long as I can go home to that flat at the end of this retreat, I'm a happy bunny. And I know it's going to be there when I get back, so I don't mind where I go, where I wander homeless, as long as I can go back to my flat, and that's my base. And when I get back, I think, oh, thank God I'm home. Home is attachment. Home, in this sense, is emotional attachment, is emotional dependency. That's what home really is. And so if I were to go back to my flat on Friday and the block of flats had been burnt down, I would be very, very unhappy. My sense of well-being would be really, really challenged. And I would fall into a pit of despair, probably, and grief. You might think, oh, for the sake of a flat, but that's what human beings are like. We're dependable beings, dependent beings. We're attached beings. We're like needy. As long as you're not enlightened, you're needy. You need something. While you've got your needs met, you're okay, but when those needs are taken away from you, you're all at sea. You don't really know what you're doing, and you feel terrible. There are many other things I'm attached to. You know, I'm attached to my wife. I hardly see my wife. You see her every few weeks for a few days, but I know I'm going to see her, so that keeps me buoyant and happy. I'm dependent on my friends, or my network of friends, the Sangha, Sri Ratna. I really need you guys. And as long as I've got the Sangha around me, I'm really happy. And the Dharma, I'm dependent on the Dharma too. So, you know, we're all dependent on many, many things. The self is dependent. But what we're aiming for is complete non-dependency. And this is what Bodhisattva is trying to do. So I would just want to go through each one of the four emotional dependencies, or the four attachments. So let's go back to the word upadana. I just want to talk about that for a little while, because it's usually translated as attachment or clinging. But actually, that's an abstract word. And it's actually got a very concrete word. It actually means fuel. Upadana means fuel. What kind of fuel? Fuel for a fire. What is the fuel for a fire? Well, logs. And the idea is that the Buddha said the whole world is on fire with greed, hatred and delusion. Those are the three fires, greed, hatred and delusion. And the thing about fire is that it clings to its fuel, doesn't it? It clings to its fuel. And it's very agitated. I don't know if you noticed in the text. This text has it, but also a lot of the early Pali texts. It's agitation is a synonym for suffering, for dukkha. Agitation is dukkha. And the fire never stays still. It's always agitated. It's never still. It's never serene, tranquil. It's always moving around, clinging to its object. And this is what we're like. So what we do is we're attached, and we keep on feeding the flames with fuel, the fuel of our attachment. Let's put another one on, and another one. And what we need to do, and the Buddha has attained nirvana, or nibbana in Pali, which is cool. It's the extinguishment of the flames, the extinguishing of the four forms of attachment. And so we go back to Lake Anavatapta right at the beginning. Lake Anavatapta, what does it mean? It means not hot. It means cool. And the Buddha, the Naga, lives deep down in that cool lake. And all the teachings come from that cool lake. They're cool. They cool the fires of attachment. So this is what a bodhisattva is. There's someone who's trying to cut off all those forms of attachment. So let's look at the four forms. The first one is sense desire. Pleasure. It's very hard to cut off one's attachment to sense desires. And in fact, you need to be careful not to just cut them off and have nothing left, because then you're just in a void. There's no pleasure at all. And the Buddha said, the first verse of the miscellaneous chapter of the Dhammapada, he said something really, really good, which is the wise person renounces or gives up, lets go of a small pleasure to get a bigger one. Yeah. That's, in a way, one of the tricks of the spiritual life, the way spiritual life works. You have to renounce the small pleasures which keep you small and limited, and go for the larger pleasures. And there's a monk called Mahanama, different from the one we heard about yesterday, who is a layman. A monk called Mahanama goes to see the Buddha, and he said, look, you've talked about giving up sense pleasures. And I've tried and tried, and I just can't give them up. And the Buddha said, yeah, I was like that before I was enlightened. That's good to know, isn't it? That the Buddha's human. Yeah, I found it really hard to give them up. And the trick for me was getting into jhana. Once I experienced jhana, it was easier to give up the sense pleasures, because jhana's more pleasurable. It's a bigger pleasure. So this is why we meditate, so that we can get into jhana, so we get so much pleasure from that, that we don't need the sense pleasure so much. Big problem for many of us is we can't get into jhana either. So what do we do? So Sangharaksha is brilliantly talked about this for us. He said, well, there are different kinds of pleasures which don't lead to clinging, which don't lead to attachment, what you might call higher pleasures. So the pleasure of nature, for instance. That's why retreat centres are in the country. You don't get a retreat centre in the middle of a city. So you go for a walk and you're, you know, it's not very nice. But here we can go out into the countryside and really enjoy the grass and the trees and the birds and the river. And that's really enjoyable. And that kind of enjoyment doesn't lead to further clinging. And then there are the arts. There's music, good music. And there's the joy of reading books. I'm staying in a room this week where this guy's got brilliant books. And some of those books in that room I've never heard of, and they're really interesting. I want to stay here for a month and read them. And they're so enjoyable to read and pick up. And when you really get into a book, it's really enjoyable. Friendship. Just the kind of experience we're having on this retreat, where we just sit opposite someone at dinner and say, we start talking and we learn about the other person and how great that is. And then it goes deeper, doesn't it? You might get to know someone quite well, and how brilliant it is for someone to really know you and you to know them. And what a pleasure that is. Sandy Denny, who's heard of Sandy Denny? Yeah, all the old people, the old men. You're not so old, but you're a singer, so you'll have heard of her. One of her great songs is The Quiet Joys of Brotherhood. What a wonderful song that is, The Quiet Joys of Brotherhood. And that's what it's like, isn't it? The Quiet Joys of Brotherhood. So giving up the sense pleasures, which, Banti has talked about the reality principle and the pleasure principle. Coming from, he actually got those terms from Freud, but he's changed them for his own teaching. And the reality principle is the insight principle, the wisdom principle, the trying to see things the way they are principle. But that has to be balanced with the pleasure principle, which is the samatha principle, the pleasure principle. And what happens when you start living the spiritual life is quite often, when people start up with the spiritual life, they're really idealistic and they start renouncing all sorts of things and giving up all sorts of things, and they're giving up those things which they're emotionally dependent upon. They think they just give them up. But what happens is they end up in a kind of void, and they get really dry and unhappy, and they can't continue anymore. And sometimes you don't see them again. They've gone right back into the world. So you have to be careful with those people and help them and say, don't give up all those things all at once. That won't help, because you need pleasure. But what you need is to refine that pleasure and make it, well, bigger in the Buddhist terms. Don't hang on to a small pleasure, but let that one go and get into a bigger pleasure and a bigger pleasure. And happiness, remember, is the highest form of happiness, said the Buddha. The highest form of pleasure. So this is how we give up. This is how we let go of our attachment to sense pleasures, not by just stopping them, cutting them off, and that's it, but by doing it strategically and tactically. You get better and better pleasures, so that you end up really, really happy. That's the first one. Second one is attachment to views. Sometimes the translators, they translate this as wrong views, but that's not right. It's not upadana micchā ditti, it's upadana ditti. So it's attachment to any views at all. And the Buddha is completely, doesn't have a view. Vajragupta once said to him, well, what is your position? And the Buddha said, I don't have a position. Or in Ratnaguna Samjayagata terms, his position is a no position. Yeah. So that's what we're aiming for, but how do we get there? Well, we can't just leapfrog over to there. We have to do it strategically again. And you need views. You need views about the way things are, because if you don't have right view, you'll just have wrong view. you've got to have views about things. And what is a view? A view is an idea about the way things are, and beneath it, sort of inform it, is a deeply held attitude. This is why sometimes in study groups it gets a bit heated, because your view might be being challenged. And that's not just an intellectual thing. That can be quite a deeply emotional thing. You're emotionally dependent on that view. It's an interesting idea, isn't it? You become really emotionally dependent on your views. Well, you don't become, you are emotionally dependent on your views. And that's why study groups can get a bit heated sometimes, because it's deeply emotional stuff. And if somebody challenges your view, they're challenging your sense of well-being, because you're emotionally dependent upon that view. So what we need to do, and yesterday I was talking about study groups and how what I try to do is get people into this state of positive bewilderment. And what that means is they let go of their views for just a few seconds. You know, oh, really? Is that not right then? Well, that's a great position to be in. It's a really good mental state, uncomfortable as it is. And it's not that at the end of the study group they go away without any views. No, they go away with a better view. And a large part of learning the Dharma and a large part of study groups is to get people to let go of that view, which is rather limiting, and take hold of another view which will be better for them at the moment. And this is what you do. You don't just sort of suddenly jump into the sky. You go up branch by branch. Let go of that one that's keeping you down there. Go to that one that's getting you a bit higher, 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 until you get to the top of the tree, and then you can let go completely. That's a brilliant image, wasn't it? That just came to me just there. You just fly into the open air sky without any views at all, but you've got to get there first. And you get there through these branches, which is your views. And so in a study group, this is what we're trying to do in a study group. And people tend to hang on to their views and get into arguments with each other about them. But what we need to do is learn how to hold our views somewhat lightly, so that we can... They've been useful up to now, they've got you to where you are, but now they're limiting you. And remember, earlier on in one of the verses, the Buddha said that the Bodhisattva, nothing limits him. Nothing limits him. So your views have got you to where you are, and they're keeping you fairly happy at the moment, but you become emotionally dependent upon them, and you need to let go a little bit and maybe get a better view, which will take you a bit higher up the tree. And then the next attachment is to rites and rituals, or perhaps a better way of talking about that is formal practices. Practices like meditation. When I say formal, I mean you sit down and you don't do anything else. You just do that practice in a formal kind of way. Meditation, puja, and so on. And so the Bodhisattva is trying to get rid of even their dependence, their attachment to the practices they do. But that's for Bodhisattvas. So most of us really need those practices. And I teach beginners, well, people from off the street, really. They come to the Manchester Buddhist Centre and I teach them how to meditate, and I want them to get really attached to their meditation, really attached to it. And sometimes at the end of a course someone says, oh, I just want to carry on meditating. Now, I don't feel good when I miss a day, and I say, that's really good. Don't feel good when you miss a day. Yeah, you just do it every single day. You get really emotionally dependent upon that practice, because When people off the street, they come and they start doing something like that, it's completely different from anything else in their life. It's a real bang. You know, their life, usually these days, people's lives are absolutely stuffed full of things to do. And they're really busy and stressed out. And you stop them and do 15 minutes on the breath, and it has a massive effect on people. And I want them to keep having that effect, so I'm encouraging them, yeah, you just keep on doing that. Get really attached to that. Now is the time for attachment, not non-attachment. So you need to get attached to those practices so you keep on doing them and become emotionally dependent on them. That's a really good dependence, because That dependence leads eventually to a no dependence. But that happens sometime later. And how does that happen? I think what happens is that at first, you know, somebody starts practicing the Dharma. What that means is they practice for about 15 minutes a day. When they actually stop and sit down and do the practice, if they do it, that's the whole of their practice for the day, is that 15, 20 minutes. The rest of the time, they've forgotten all about it. The first few years of my life as an order member, I probably practiced about an hour a day. The rest of the time, it's just, didn't know what I was doing. But at least I had that hour a day where I was practicing. So you do that, and you become dependent upon that. But as time goes on, you learn how to practice all the rest of the time, the rest of the day. So what happens then is that your practice becomes a no practice. Your practice becomes, that's just your life. Practice is life. So it's not separate. It's not something you add on to your day. Practice is life. Charya. And then you can let go of formal practices. Then you can let go of your dependence on them, because you don't really need it that much, because your whole life is a practice. So it's only then that you can let go of your formal practices. And then the final one is dependence on a view of yourself. Traditionally, this is self-view, the idea that there is an unchanging, eternal, independent self deep inside yourself. That's the traditional one. But the Buddha was very, very subtle. Much more subtle than most people know, because most people don't actually read the Pali Canon. But when you read the Pali Canon on the self, it's really subtle. It's so hard to understand his position on the self. It's not at all clear. You know, when people say the Buddha taught there's no self, well, sometimes he did, and sometimes he taught there's a self. And sometimes he taught you that you need to strengthen your sense of yourself. It's really not very clear. And in the end, I think all we can say is the Buddha, it was not a doctrine, but it was a method. And in a way, the no-self doctrine, the other day I talked about it as being realizing yourself is dependent, it's not independent. But another way of talking about it is what the Buddha was really saying is, don't be so preoccupied with yourself. It's not that important. But we have views of ourselves. Every one of us has an idea of who we are. And that's more or less inaccurate. Last week I was doing a teacher training course at Adhisthana for new order members. There were seven of them. And it was really great, really good fun. And what I said at the beginning was, look, this isn't just a training how to teach in a technical sense. This is actually a spiritual training, because what happens on a teacher training course, Dharma teacher training course, is someone will stand up and do something, like give a talk or lead a study group for a while. And then at the end of it, everyone will tell them what they thought of it. And that is really challenging to your self-view. Because you think you're a certain kind of person, you did this. And then you hear from other people, and it's just like, oh, it wasn't like that then for them at all. Their view of who I am is very different from mine. It's not to say their view is more accurate, but it's very interesting when eight people say, no, I don't think it was like that at all. It was like, you came across like this. And if eight people say that to you, that's really interesting information which you should reflect on. And one of the very nice things that happened last week is that three of them were really good teachers, and two of them didn't know that. They didn't know they were good teachers. And it was very comical in a way. They do this really good session, maybe a really good talk, and always I say to them, how do you think it went? Get their own self-view out in the open, and they, oh, well, I made a mistake there, and I should have done that, and I thought I went on too long there. And then, you want to hear what other people think? And they were always going, that was brilliant, it was so moving, it was wonderful. And when that happens a couple of times, you think that the person would change their view. But they didn't. They kept on thinking they weren't very good. And all the evidence was against that. But they just kept on saying, oh, well, you know, I've never been a very good teacher. I don't think I'll ever make a very good teacher. And we were like... So I sat down next to them, one of them, at a mealtime, and I sort of started having a bit of fun. And I said, so it's interesting, you've got this view of yourself as not being a good teacher, and all eight of us have said, you're really, really good. It's interesting, that, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. She said, I hear it, but it doesn't really go in. And I said, why is that? Why don't you accept that? Why didn't you take that on? And she said, oh, I think it's fear. And I thought, that's bang on. It's fear. Because going back to the Buddha's statement about happiness, giving up a smaller happiness for a bigger one, going into a bigger place is more fearful than staying into your small, secure place. And I think Tanisaro Bhikkhu reckons that the Buddha's position on the self was he didn't have one. And one of the things he was trying to do was to get people to change their view of themselves to a better one. Better, better, better. And then eventually they forget about themselves. There's a kind of self-forgetting. So, yeah. So that's self-view. And the Bodhisattva, in verse 16, the Buddha says that the Bodhisattva wants to let go of all their attachments, all those four upadanas, let them all go. So this is what we're aiming for. But we have to do it intelligently. That's verse 16. Verse 17. Why are they spoken of as great beings? Great being is Mahasattva. And very often in Mahayana texts you get the two terms together. Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, great beings. Because of their greatness, they rise above the masses of ordinary beings. You could say, in Bansi's terminology, they become individuals. They're no longer members of the group. They're individuals. They think of themselves. They're emotionally independent, and so on. And they cut off the wrong views of a great many beings. This is why they are called great beings. So they cut off the wrong views. That's the thing that they do. That's how they help beings. That's how they save all living beings. That's why the vow, the Bodhisattva vow, is to gain enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. So what the Bodhisattvas do for living beings, they help them cut off their wrong views. What is a wrong view? A wrong view is an idea about the way things are which is not helpful, which doesn't accord with the way things are, and therefore limits you in a place of suffering. And the Mahayana considered wrong views to be really important. And the reason they're so important is because while you've got a wrong view, you will act from that wrong view unskillfully, and you'll... the unskillful act you do out of a wrong view, because you've got that wrong view, you won't see that unskillful act as unskillful. You'll think it's skillful. So you'll continue to do unskillful acts on the basis of wrong view, and you'll never change your behaviour. You'll never feel remorse for that. So you might think, for instance, that you should speak harshly to people who disagree with you about the Dharma. Or you might even feel it's okay to harm people who are enemies of the Dharma. That's a good thing to do, harm them, shut them up. Or you might even go so far as to kill people in the name of your religion, because they've said bad things about your religion, so you're willing to kill them. And that's based on the view that it's okay to do that. Now, killing other living beings or harming them in any other way anyway is really unskillful. But if you think it's okay to do that, that means you'll continue to do that again and again and again, and you'll never feel remorse for that. So that's a really terrible thing. So for Mahayana Buddhism, wrong views are the root of everything that's wrong, all unskillful action. So the main thing that a Bodhisattva has to do is get people to see that their wrong views are wrong views. They're not helping them or anybody else. They're keeping them trapped. So how does a Bodhisattva do that? The only way you can really effectively help someone understand that their view is a wrong one if you're not attached to your own. While you're attached to your view, you just have an argument. This is what happens in study groups. People just have an argument because, no, you're wrong. This is what happens. No, you're wrong. That's not the way to see it. No, no, that is the way to see it. Your way is not the way to see it. This is what happens in an argument. And if you try to cut someone else's wrong view off from the basis of your attachment to your own view, they're just getting into an argument with you. It will go nowhere. So you, first of all, need to let go of your attachment to your view in order to enter into their world and help them out and show them that their view doesn't lead anywhere good. And you can only do that if you're sitting loose to your own view. Hence, the Bodhisattva's view is a no view. A no view in the sense that it's not really an attachment they've got. But it's a good one to have. It's better than that view over there, but they're not really attached to it. Verse 18. With great generosity, great intelligence, and great power, they mount the great vehicle of the victorious ones, the unequalled Mahayana. Clad in great armour, they will paralyse the evil one. This is why they are called great beings. Just before I talk about that view, there was a pause there before I went on to it, because I knew there was something else I wanted to say about the previous verse. And I've just remembered what it is. So I'll go back to the previous verse. I talked about the importance of, if you're going to help someone out with their wrong view, you need to not be attached to yours, otherwise you get into an argument. How do you do that? How do you get to a point where you're not attached to your own views? Well, this is where reflection comes in. As you know, I've written a book about reflection, and I've done a number of reflection retreats and workshops. And what I've noticed in doing those retreats and workshops is that people usually find reflection really hard work. Such hard work that they're not really willing to do it, to be honest. So I set people an exercise. Okay, go off and reflect on this. And then they come back a little while later and they haven't done. They haven't done the job. And the reason they haven't done is they're unable to. It's such hard work that they can't get their mind to do it. People don't realise how hard it is to really think. When we talk about one of the characteristics of the individual being the individual thinks for themselves, what people usually imagine that means is they pick up all the thoughts of other people that they like and they put them all together in their own system. But that's not thinking for yourself. That's just the freedom to have other people's thoughts. Thinking for yourself is a completely different thing. And it's really important. Because if you don't think for yourself, you're just hanging on to dogma. You'll just be an ideologue. You won't really be able to help other people with their own thinking, their own reflection. You won't be convincing when you're talking to someone, because they pick up that you're just hanging on to this view. It's what religious people often do. And that's why religious people are very often not convincing, because they're so emotionally dependent on their view that they can't really think about it. So there's an interesting dialogue there, isn't there, between the ability to really think about something and your emotional dependence upon it. So to really reflect on something, really important, and then that makes you a much better teacher. If you can reflect on a topic, usually what younger order members do when they're giving a talk, they just gather all together all the teachings they've heard from Bansi and Subhuti and whoever, Padmavanchu, and they put them all together in a nice talk. And that's their talk, and that's a good thing to do. But much better if that order member really thinks and reflects and comes to their own conclusions about things. That's much more exciting for people to listen to. Anyway, back to verse 18. With great generosity, great intelligence, the word is buddhi, which means intelligence, and great power. Majesty, great majesty. They mount the great vehicle. Great vehicle is Mahayana of the victorious ones. Clad in great armour, they will paralyse the evil one. The evil one is Mara. This is why they are called great beings. So here we've got a new metaphor. The main metaphor of the Buddha was the path, Magga, leading to the goal, enlightenment. Here's a new metaphor. The path is not mentioned once here, but you've got this new metaphor for the great vehicle. You mount the great vehicle which leads you to enlightenment. And we get that again with the next verse, I think. No, we don't get it with the next verse. We get it with verse 21. So why don't we skip over to verse 21. Why is this called the Bodhiyana, the vehicle of awakening? There's a new term here, Bodhiyana. Notice that yana is vehicle. Sometimes it is now translated as way. But this is just, there's a reason why it's translated as way by some people, to do with the Chinese. But that turns it into a path again. But it's a vehicle. Why is this called the Bodhiyana? Mounted upon it, one leads all beings to nirvana. So you're on this vehicle. This vehicle is like a great divine chariot, as vast as space, Akasha Dhatu, as vast as space. So now you've got this metaphor of a chariot, the divine chariot, as vast as space, which is really, really huge thing. This, the best of all vehicles, leads one to happiness, well-being and ease, which is where we're heading, isn't it? Okay, so then we'll go now to verses 19 and 20, and I think we'll take them together. 19, when a conjuring trick is performed at a crossroads, an illusion of a great crowd of people all having their heads cut off, no one is really harmed. So this is interesting. In my research for this talk, I was looking something up. I can't remember what it was now, but there was a Tibetan teacher talking about conjuring tricks at crossroads, because this is a trope in Buddhist, all Buddhist texts. You've always got this conjuring trick at a crossroads. And this Tibetan teacher said, it's actually not really a conjuring trick, it's a puppet show. You have puppet shows, and the puppets are the people. And it's the puppets that get their heads cut off. And they probably do really get their heads cut off. But it's an illusion. That's really interesting, isn't it? You get these puppet shows, and like puppet shows are the ancient Indian versions of the cinema or the theatre. You go to the cinema and all sorts of things are happening in the cinema, but it's not really happening. You know, you get really involved in it. You identify with the hero and the baddies are chasing him and you get really anxious. And that's what thrillers are. You get really, really anxious until the end and it will go and you go like that. It's just an illusion. It's just an illusion. And what the Buddha is saying here is it's a conjuring trick. In the same way, a bodhisattva knows that the whole world is like a conjuring trick and he's not afraid. You get this again, not afraid. The bodhisattva is not afraid of the world. I want to go back to the four upadanas, actually, something I forgot to say earlier, which is this is what makes, you know, right at the beginning we had this heroic spirits intended, to use Konza's translation, or the heroic to Shraddhapas. And I said, you know, what's all that about? Well, what it's about is that we're emotionally dependent on the four kinds of attachment. And what the Bodhisattva is trying to do is cut off those sources of emotional dependence. That's what the heroism is all about. That's what makes you a hero. You become independent. Remember that verse, the Bodhisattva wanders homeless, independent of all phenomena. So in the same way, a bodhisattva knows that the whole world is like a conjuring trick and is not afraid. And then in the next verse, you've got the five skandhas again. They're bound, not liberated. They're not real. The best kind of person, someone who's not faint-hearted, approaches awakening in this way, clad in the best kind of armour. So this is another metaphor that the Mahayana is very keen on, very fond of, this idea of clad in the great armour. So what is the great armour? So you're on this divine chariot, clad in the great armour. It's quite a metaphor, isn't it? And the divine chariot is as vast as the space. So what is the armour? The armour, in a way, is a no armour, because all it is your realisation that the whole world is like a conjuring trick. You realise that everything that you see and other people see is not really the way it seems. Everything is illusory. And you don't mind that. That's why you're clad in the armour, because it doesn't attack you. You don't feel defensive about that. You're okay with that. And we'll finish, I think, with 22. We cannot grasp where they go when they transcend the world. We say that they have gone to nirvana, but we cannot comprehend what this means. This is really important, isn't it? We talk about these things. We have an argument in the study group about nirvana. Two people having a real set-to about it. It's this. No, it's not. It's that. Neither of them know what they're talking about. Because how can you know what nirvana is unless you've experienced nirvana? So although we talk about nirvana, we can't grasp what that means. We don't even know that we don't know what it means. One thing is to know that you don't know something, and another thing is to not know that you don't know it. That's much worse. And because we talk about these things, we give ourselves the impression that we know, but we don't really know. And it's true of anybody who you know, who is more wise than you. You can't grasp who they are, what they are. They're beyond you. It's like a dog. A dog doesn't understand their master. A dog just thinks their master is another kind of dog, the head of the pack. They've got no idea about self-consciousness. They don't know. If they knew, they'd be self-conscious. So they've got no idea who their master is. And it's the same with us. We've got no idea, like, who Bansi is. People have all sorts of opinions about Bansi. He's this, he's that. You don't know. You don't know who Bansi is, because he's vast. We've just got no real idea about who he is. And this is the way it is for anybody who's... If you're not an individual, you don't know what an individual is. You really don't know. Jordan Peterson's in the news a lot, isn't he? Great guy. I really love him. And some people hate him because they think he's left-wing. The right-wing people really hate him because and the left-wing people really hate him because they think he's right-wing. He's neither of those things. He's not left-wing or right-wing. He's just who he is. He's thinking. He's thinking out loud to people. He's saying what he thinks. But people didn't really understand that. And it's very hard to understand someone who's further along the path than you. You have to admit that you don't really know them. So we cannot grasp where they go when they transcend the world. We say they have gone to nirvana, a phrase that we use, but we cannot comprehend what this means. So we've used that phrase, but we don't know what the phrase means. Just as we cannot say where a fire goes when it is extinguished, we cannot say where they go when they attain nirvana. I just want to end with this idea of the fire and extinguishing, because we had the fire earlier, and the Buddha is called nirvana. The fire has gone out. And so there's a couple of places in the Pali Canon where somebody, and one of them is Vajragupta, goes to see the Buddha. And Vajragupta, there's a number of Pali suttas where Vajragupta comes to see the Buddha. He's a wanderer from another tradition, and he asks him all these physical questions, the unanswerable questions. You know, is the world finite or infinite, and so on. And the Buddha doesn't answer them. And one of the questions he asked at the end of a long series of questions is, so what happens to a Buddha when they die? Do they carry on? Are they immortal? Or are they snuffed out completely? And the Buddha says, oh, you can't say. It's beyond those kind of categories. And Vajragosa keeps on. And then the Buddha says, look, it's like a fire. So when a fire goes out, you can't say where it's gone, can you? No, you can't say where it's gone. So that's just like with the Buddha. You just can't say where he's gone. Now, for us, modern Westerners, that simile doesn't work because we think that the fire's gone out and it's extinguished, gone completely. So that's not what the Buddha was talking about. The Buddha shared his conception for fire with all ancient Indians was that the fire is always present. And when you make a fire, you're just calling upon the god Agni to show himself there for you. There it is again. But when you put the fire out, it's not extinguished. It's somehow in the universe, but it's just gone out from that particular place. So fire is a very interesting idea in ancient India. So when the Buddha says the Buddha dying is like a fire going out, it doesn't mean what we think it means. It means it's mysterious. It's a mysterious category, a no category. There are no categories you can use to describe where the fire is when it's gone out, because it's still existing in some way, but not manifest to you. So that's just like what the Buddha is. And I want to end with this marvellous phrase that the Buddha uses at the end of his talk with Vajragosa. Freed from the classification or the categorization of form, the Buddha is deep, Gambhira, deep, boundless. Boundless. Boundless is apamayo, which means immeasurable, infinite, boundless. Hard to fathom. Fathom is pariyoga, to dive into, to penetrate, hard to get into, hard to understand. Like the great ocean. The Buddha is deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the great ocean. And that's where we're headed.